The modern economy offers a lot of variety. You can work in a factory fixing the robots that do the actual manufacturing work. You can drive people around town in your car and charge them for it. You can work a lot of different jobs, making a little money here and a little money there. Those last two examples are clearly from the gig economy, rideshare drivers, TaskRabbit, odd jobbers, and more. How are they doing? That is one of the central questions of a new book by Alexandria Ravenel called Hustle and Gig, Struggling and Surviving in the Sharing Economy. Alexandria Ravenel is an assistant professor of sociology at Mercy College in New York. She's also a visiting scholar at the Institute for Public Knowledge at NYU, New York University. Alexandria, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So just to start, is this a life you have known firsthand?
Ah, that's always the question everyone wants to know. Mm-hmm. So I actually got interested in studying this while I was adjuncting for a number of colleges and running a small consulting business. So I was in the gig economy in the sense of working multiple jobs, but I was not working directly for Uber, TaskRabbit, or any of these platform-based services.
So as you were cobbling together work from a couple of different sources, was any of them paying you benefits or anything like that?
No, of course not.
All right. So you give us some case histories first, and give us a sense of how working conditions compare with regular work for the people who are in the gig economy.
So most workers in the gig economy are independent contractors, and that means they are outside the standard workplace protections that full-time workers or workers in the mainstream economy receive. They are not protected against discrimination, sexual harassment. They don't receive unemployment. They are not protected in the case of injury on the job, and they don't receive any contributions to Social Security or Medicaid. So they're very much on their own. They are essentially, they have fewer protections than their grandparents did when they were working.
And maybe even a couple of generations before that. You make comparisons between the conditions in the gig economy and the early industrial age.
I do, yes, because in many cases, it's a movement forward to the past. We think about this technology as moving us forward, but really it's just taking away a number of workplace protections and leaving workers very close to worse off than they were before.
So what are the reasons that people will often give for taking up gig work? I mean, I assume some people do this because they think it does sound like a good thing.
Right. So all the workers that I interviewed spoke about how it seemed like a great thing in the beginning. A lot of times the companies tell them that they can be their own boss. This is entrepreneurship for the masses. You know, you can set your own hours, pick your own paycheck, be your own boss, determine your schedule. But the workers get into it and they realize it's not that. For most workers, they actually laughed when I asked if they thought they were entrepreneurs. And instead, they view it as simply a way to supplement a stagnant salary. You know, expenses are going up and paychecks are not. And so people very much feel like they need another way to help support themselves.
So lofty talk about entrepreneurs and people striking out on their own in society, but it sounds like most of them aren't getting the kinds of rewards that being independent would give.
Exactly. The only exception would be those workers that come in with high levels of skills and capital, and they are able to actually start businesses. But those businesses involve a lot of financial investment. So renting multiple apartments and turning them into Airbnb hotels, that's something you can be an entrepreneur. But if you need $20,000 to $30,000 per apartment in startup costs, that's out of reach for most workers.
Is that just for the cost of a lease for a year or something? Is that what the $20,000 is? Or?
Well, so here in New York, rentals are very expensive, but the $20,000 is actually just a startup cost, not even a full year of rental. So it would be furniture for an empty apartment,
broker fees.
Mm-hmm. Right. First month, last month. It adds up very quickly.
Let's focus on inequality for a moment. You bring in Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist who writes for The New York Times, who describes a great divergence. What is that?
So it's the great divergence between between the upper class and everyone else. So after we had a period of prosperity after World War II and going into the 70s. And then we start to see this divergence where more and more wealth, more and more income starts to accrue to the wealthiest 1% and a little bit to the 5%. And then there's a growing divergence between that top 1% and everyone else.
And it's caused, do we know all the causes? I mean, we've been arguing about inequality, obviously, for several years now.
Right. So there are a number of causes. One would be that we've seen a lot of work being outsourced. We've also seen just a loss of sort of protections for workers in terms of pensions. We've seen a lot of risk being shifted to workers. So if companies have a period of slowdown, they're more likely to shed workers. We've seen very much a change in terms of more work being done by fewer people. So we've also seen automation. And all of these things have very much come together along with a weakening of unions in order to sort of keep the middle class and below in one position while the upper class is able to move forward.
And of course, the result then is things like what we're seeing in the gig economy, where people have their work conditions rolled back to what previous generations might have found acceptable, but people didn't for a long time here. In fact, you found some workers who are not getting paid in some circumstances. For what, for example, Alexandria?
Right. So in the book Hustle and Gig, I actually talk about one worker who did a kitchen surfing gig. And it turned out that the client complained and the company was holding on to her money. And she was out thousands of dollars worth of food costs. And then she was also out the money for her time. And then if workers find themselves on a task that is questionable or criminally questionable, sometimes the company will end the task and they'll get paid for an hour, even though they've spent multiple hours in conversation with the client, showing up for the task, and moving forward.
Wow. So, yeah, cases in which people really don't get any money out of the gig that they got hired for. The book is called Hustle and Gig, Struggling and Surviving in the Sharing Economy. It's the work of Alexandria Ravenel, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Mercy College in New York City. You can join the conversation on The Exchange by phone and email as we go further into an exploration of the gig economy with a number of dozens of workers that Alexandria talked to. We'll hear more of their stories and hear from you, we hope, when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the gig economy today with a sociologist. Alexandria J. Ravenel is an assistant professor of sociology at Mercy College in the greater New York area. And she's written a book in which she talked to a lot of people. Remember, she's a sociologist, not an economist. The book is called Hustle and Gig, Struggling and Surviving in the Sharing Economy. So a lot of personal stories in here. And you can join the conversation on the Exchange as we get to explore the gig economy through the lives of the people who take part in it. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you talked to 80 workers across four services. We can skip Uber and Airbnb, I think, Alexandria. Most people just know those. But describe, if you would, a little bit about TaskRabbit and kitchen surfing.
Of course. So TaskRabbit is a personal assistant site, and kitchen surfing was a rent-a-chef site. So before it went out of business, workers could advertise themselves as chefs and be hired to do everything from a full meal for 100 people, a wedding, down to a price-fixed dinner where they'd show up and cook a meal for up to, I think, 6 people one night.
So the fact that kitchen surfing went out of business would seem to be one of the other unstated so far issues with the gig economy is that the place that's coordinating your work can disappear.
Exactly. And that's really difficult for workers because they're often left out of the loop. They don't know about sort of the day-to-day. When you go to work every day, you have a good idea of whether or not your company is doing well. But gig workers are often on the sidelines. And when the company closes, they're often left with no recourse. They don't get unemployment. And they've lost their reviews, they've lost back office support and advertising that they were relying on.
Oh, I thought about that part of it. So because you're not employed by someone, you're technically a contractor in a lot of these cases, you don't get unemployment.
Exactly.
Wow.
There's no safety net.
You write of the risk of the companies that you profile here. Again, it was Uber, Airbnb, TaskRabbit, and Kitchen Surfing, the late Kitchen Surfing, we should say. And you write of the risk of them creating platform monopolies. Is this the sense where people would always kind of go to those places first?
Exactly, yes. So the platform monopoly is the idea that they sort of have a dominance in the industry, and that makes it very difficult for somebody to get work in an area if they're not on that platform. And because these platforms are powerful and they can deactivate you at a moment's notice, I say we have on-whim unemployment in the gig economy. It means that you're very vulnerable to the power of the platforms. You know, in my book, I actually have an image of a young man who's panhandling for money to activate his phone so he can do an Uber courier service. And without that $30 activation, he simply can't get any work.
So barriers to entry, just that people have to pay just to look for work in the first place.
Exactly.
Wow. Lest anyone think this is all a downer, you identify several categories here. Strugglers, strivers, and success stories. And tell us then where you draw the line between them, Alexandria.
Sure. So the success stories are the people who have the life that many of us want. They are actually able to do entrepreneurship through the gig economy because they have high levels of skill and capital investment. And they are able to answer their emails from bars and from beaches and to really establish a very strong source of income, but they are very much in the minority. Many more workers fall into the striver and struggler category. And the strugglers are those individuals who are very much down on their luck. They are often unemployed, long-term unemployed, in some cases undocumented workers. They've had some disruptions in their life, and this is sort of the only option that's still available to them as a way to make money. And then the strivers are the people who are doing it as just a way to get some additional funds. So these are the middle-class individuals that want to supplement their income or working class, and this is a way for them to pay for vacations, get a little bit of savings, maybe get themselves out of credit card debt or student loan debt.
Is there any way to know what percentages might exist? You mentioned that the success stories are minority, but, I mean, do we have any hard numbers on, you know, how well people are doing in the gig economy?
We have very few numbers about the gig economy in general, which is very much a problem. In terms of statistics, we know that there are more Uber drivers, for instance, than dentists in the United States, but a lot of these definitions are very difficult to come by because workers move in and out of the gig economy. So, for instance, Uber at times has used the definition of anyone who gave a ride in the last 6 months as an active worker. I don't know about you, but if I stop going to work for even a couple of weeks, I'm no longer an active worker.
So it's just hard to track that for sure. We're talking to Alexandria Ravenel about her book on the gig economy, Hustle and Gig, Struggling and Surviving in the Sharing Economy. Here's a call from Kristen in Dorena, Oregon. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, hi. Thank you.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, so I just have a question, kind of a broader sociological question, which is it seems to me that it's almost built into our system right now that the rich do keep getting richer and things do keep getting more scarce for those who are working. And I'm just sort of wondering if there are some ways to stop that. It just seems like there are just so many built-in ways that this money just keeps getting funneled to people who are already very wealthy. And I'm just wondering if there are some things that could help help offset that so that these gig jobs aren't as necessary. I'm just sort of wondering what can help reverse the trend. I know that's kind of a broad question.
No, but it's a good one, and I appreciate you bringing it up, Kristen. Thanks for that.
Sure. So, of course, there's a growing conversation right now about individuals having sort of a constant income, having, and of course, I'm totally going to blank on the term right now.
Universal basic income?
UBI? Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes, universal basic income as a way to ensure that nobody falls into poverty. That would probably be a good place to start. The research on this is a little bit back and forth. So we've seen some studies on it where it seems to be very useful, and then other studies where there have been problems perhaps with the study, but it seemed possibly a little questionable. So one other thing that we could definitely do is look at the minimum wage in various places and make sure that the minimum wage is higher. And that would probably also have repercussions for the rest of the jobs in that community. And we should probably also look at things that people are spending their money on. So if we had universal health care, if we had more support for families, whether through paid leave for parents or supplements in terms of paying for high-quality child care, those would, and of course, doing something about student loan debt, that would also help to sort of equalize the situation with middle-class and working-class individuals and those that are very wealthy.
Okay, so quite a few things that are on the table, certainly as consideration. And thanks for the call for that, Kristen and Dorina. Coming back to the difficulty of knowing how many people are in the gig economy, Alexandria, you were pointing out that of the 80 people you talked to, some of them lie to people about working in the gig economy.
They do, yes. You know, one of the things that was very surprising to me in this research is because its market is entrepreneurship, a number of workers were actually embarrassed about what they were doing. They talk about lying to friends, saying that they are temping instead of tasking. Individuals talked about relationships that ended as a result because their partner was embarrassed that they were driving for Uber or they were doing personal assistant work through TaskRabbit. It's really not the entrepreneurial utopia that the companies make it out to be.
Well, and then some of the reasons for lying are clear. For example, in New York City, where there are some serious constraints, apparently, on short-term rentals.
Right. So in New York City, it is illegal to rent out an apartment that is part of a, multiple dwelling unit, which is most apartment units, for less than 30 days. The only exception is if the individual has access to the entire apartment, and then they can, it seems, get through as a roommate policy. But in that case, the owner or resident actually has to be there the entire time. And so most of the rentals in New York City are actually illegal. And it's a major problem. It's driving up the cost of rent for individuals in the city.
It's an issue for communities big and small because, if you're if you're losing some of your potential rental stock to people who are just staying for a week or a few weeks or even a couple of days, it's a different kind of situation for people who want to live long term.
Exactly, yeah. And those apartments are not just taken out for those couple of days. Usually they're being used as rentals or short-term hotels year-round.
Indeed. Alexandria Ravenel, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Hustle and Gig, Struggling and Surviving in the Sharing Economy. Maybe you have a story about working in the sharing economy, have picked up rides for a few extra bucks or worked through TaskRabbit or something. We'd like to hear from you or just get your thoughts in general on the system that is establishing itself in our country. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So back to square one on this concept of a sharing economy, which you write, Alexandria, feels like a trip into bizarro world. Why?
It does. So a number of the workers that I interviewed actually talked about being sexually harassed on the job, but because this is peer-to-peer work, they don't use the term sexual harassment. They've been told by the companies that they don't have rights, they don't have protections, and they've been told that this is working with your peers. And so when they find themselves in these really difficult situations, like working swingers parties or being sexually propositioned or invited for threesomes or in some cases even actually touched by clients, they use this term weird or bizarro world, bizarro land, because they're showing that there's a difficulty going on here, but they don't even have the words for it. There's sort of a loss of political language in the gig economy as workers lose other rights also.
You pointed out that you tried to get to the trust and safety portion of Airbnb's site and you couldn't get there?
Exactly, yes. So as I say, Airbnb and other services often say that they believe in trust and safety, but they require you to accept all of their arbitration agreements and legal agreements before they let you in. So, and other people may trust in God. They trust in, apparently, lawyers.
Wow. So, okay, we're going to kind of getting a few whacks on the idea of trust here, but trust and community are touted as reasons for a sharing economy. And how are we doing on the community score?
We're not doing well on the community score. So for a lot of these workers, they're not really interacting with people in positive ways. They're actually being treated very much like servants. There's one young woman that I interviewed who's actually an adjunct professor, and she runs an errand for someone, and she is supposed to go get a pair of pants hemmed. And instead of putting the money for the pants, the cash in her pocket, she puts it in the bag, and the client slaps her hand. And that's not really a contributor to community or helping workers to feel like they are a part of things. That's fairly abusive behavior. But we hear these stories over and over again.
Well, and the sense of, a face-to-face sharing, like, here's my lawnmower, here's my car, here's my house kind of thing, is sort of negated by the picture of lockboxes you show on a fence in Manhattan. What's that about?
Exactly. So in New York City, because there are so many of these Airbnb rentals, they need a way to get the keys to the clients. And so there are lockboxes everywhere, hundreds of lockboxes in the city attached to fencing materials, attached to the building across the street. And that way, the host doesn't actually need to interact with the guest at all. They just tell them where the lockbox is, they give them the code, and the person goes and gets the key and lets themselves in. And this is one of the components where we see this loss of community. It was supposed to be about sharing and interacting with your guest, and really it's just about an efficient way for people to make more money, take advantage of arbitrage.
Well, I'll leave it here and you pick it up later, that sort of thing. And the four platforms you cover, again, it's Uber, Airbnb, TaskRabbit, and the late Kitchen Surfing. Do workers ever meet people who actually work directly for the companies?
Very rarely. So for TaskRabbit, when they had their large pivot a few years ago, they actually had a couple of meetings where they invited workers to come in and learn about the pivot. And the pivot was when the organization moved from sort of a bidding marketplace, kind of like eBay, to more of a temp agency where workers were just available for a set number of hours on a preset schedule. But in terms of meeting people who are higher up in the organization, very rarely, and it doesn't seem like the platforms are all that interested in speaking to the workers. A lot of times if somebody has a problem, they have to send in an email or they're directed to a call center.
Oh, wow. We're talking about the gig economy with Alexandria Ravenel. Her book is Hustle and Gig, Struggling and Surviving in the Sharing Economy. Here's a call from Richard in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. A couple of comments. First, in 1969 and 1970, I drove a taxi cab for ILEX Service Company in New York, in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't understand why everybody draws a distinction between taxi cabs and Uber and Lyft based on my experience. We would go to the garage at whatever hours we wanted. We would show up, sit down, wait for a cab to come in. Then we would be able to drive the cab for as many hours as we wanted, and we were paid salary on a reported on a W-2. Why is that fundamentally different from what an Uber driver or a Lyft driver does? In other words, I think they should be treated as employees and get the same benefits, if you want to call them that, that employees do, including withholding and Social Security and so forth, without having to report it as self-employed people would have to.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's get a response from Alexandria before we have to go to a break. Thanks for the call, Richard. Appreciate that. So I mean, this has been talked about a lot, obviously, in a place like New York City where the cab industry is so big and had been so lucrative. A lot of discussions about this.
Right. Thank you. I'm so glad Richard asked that question. So one of the big differences between taxi drivers and Uber and Lyft drivers in New York is that they don't have any of the same physical protections either. So they don't have the workplace protections of being a W-2 worker, but they also don't have things like partitions protecting them from passengers. They don't have emergency buttons in case they're being mugged or robbed. They are using their own private cars, and those cars are not designed for ride-sharing in many cases. So, for instance, a taxi cab, the seats are created in such a way that they're not supposed to absorb liquids. But your average leather or cloth upholstery will absorb liquids. And so it's not unusual for workers to discover that somebody has peed in their car or someone has thrown up in it, and they're responsible for cleaning it up. And it's a lot harder to clean up in your average car than in a taxi cab. And, of course, Richard has a great point. You know, if they were W-2 workers then, in terms of the actual work itself, it's not that different. And so Uber and Lyft drivers should probably be treated as W-2 workers also.
But they are not, and that is the reason we're talking about this subject with Alexandria J. Ravenel. She is an assistant professor of sociology at Mercy College in the greater New York area. Her book is called Hustle and Gig, Struggling and Surviving in the Sharing Economy, publication date March 12th. We get a little advance word here from Alexandria herself, and we'll come back and talk more with her. And if you'd like to join the conversation, we will take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. It's the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about the sharing economy, the idea that not everybody needs to have a lawnmower or a car or a house for that matter. If you've got stuff that you can share with other people, why not put it out there in the world? Well, it turns into something else when it overcrosses something we call the gig economy. And that's what Alexandria Ravenel from Mercy College in New York is exploring in her book, Hustle and Gig, Struggling and Surviving in the Sharing Economy. You can join the conversation on the exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Alexandria, you're writing here about the casualization of labor. That's an interesting term. What did the authors of The Jobless Future predict 25 years ago?
Oh, wow. There's my history lesson, right? Yeah. So they predicted that workers were going to be replaced by machines and that individuals would not need to be working. And instead, what we've seen is that workers are working even more hours than ever before. I give the example in the book that about 15 years ago, George W. Bush was president, and he was asked about, he met a woman who had multiple jobs, and he says, oh, you're uniquely American, that's fantastic. And everyone made fun of him. And now today, we think it's great that people have all these side hustles and they're doing additional jobs. We've very much lost this idea of leisure and the idea that someone should only have to work one job and be able to support themselves on that.
That's the one I keep getting stuck on, is the idea that, I mean, we had people 100 years ago talking about the fact that we should all end up working less over time as more things get automated. This is before anybody used the term robots on a regular basis. And yet we've reached a point where people seem to need to work 40 hours plus to be able to make ends meet.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, even 10 years ago, what was the most popular book? The 4-Hour Work Week. And now we've definitely moved in the opposite direction after the Great Recession.
So of the 80 workers that you interviewed, and these were fairly extensive interviews, it sounds like, did any of the workers you meet reach or thought they would reach the financial and other goals they had for getting into the gig economy?
Oh, that is a good question. Some of them thought they might be able to eventually pay off their credit cards and maybe get themselves into a little bit more stable of a situation. That was for more of the strugglers. For the individuals who were success stories, though, this was in many cases sort of a supplementary income in addition to full-time jobs, or they were making so much that they had really hit any financial goal they could have had. There was a lawyer I was speaking to was a corporate attorney, probably making $200,000 in his full-time job, and then making another $70,000 as an Airbnb hotelier in his free time.
Ah, so there's the person who can afford the $20,000 startup cost for an Airbnb in Manhattan.
Exactly.
So is anybody getting rich off the labor of the gig workers? I mean, are Uber and Lyft and the like, or TaskRabbit, are they making piles of money up in the corporate offices?
So good question on that. In terms of Uber and Lyft, it looks like they're still having some problems in terms of making a profit. They're still showing high levels of loss. And of course, since they're talking about going public this year, that's a little questionable. A lot of these companies actually have very high customer acquisition costs. And in some cases, they also have high worker acquisition costs. So they have to pay bonuses in order to get people to start working for these platforms. That said, if you were working in the corporate office, you have benefits and you have a cushy salary. So you're definitely doing much better than the frontline workers.
You mentioned the acquisition costs just now and trying to convince people to get started. You also mentioned a few moments ago about TaskRabbit and how it changed the way it was approaching things. It's pivot. And I just wonder if this is a fairly common thing, at least among the four services that you profiled here. Again, Uber, Airbnb, TaskRabbit, and Kitchen Surfing, which is no longer with us. Did they all pivot at some point and change the mechanisms by which people were compensated?
So TaskRabbit had a very large pivot where, in addition to moving from the bidding marketplace, they also moved to the temp agency type of format. And on top of that, they also very much increased their take of what workers were making. So they went, they increased their commission to 30% and then put in about a 7.5% trust and safety fee. In terms of other services like Uber, they've been experimenting in a number of different ways. They haven't done a full pivot, but they very much experimented in terms of the commission rates, the rates paid by drivers. Right now, they're doing sort of testing regarding surge pricing and whether or not drivers should get the full chunk of surge. So we've definitely seen some changes there. And this is one of the risks that workers encounter with the gig economy, that the rules are very much changed at a moment's notice, and the rules are controlled by the platforms, and workers have very little recourse if they change things.
So are the changes ever really to the worker benefit? It sounds like when Uber, for example, drops its rates, as you talked about, or in some cases adjusts them upward, but it's still not the kind of thing that ends up putting a lot more money, if any, in the pockets of the people doing the work.
Exactly. TaskRabbit most recently, after being owned by IKEA, actually reduced their commissions from 1.30% down to 15%, but they also implemented a fee for workers to apply to be on the platform.
A fee?
Yes.
How big is that fee?
I've heard $20, but some workers have told me it's actually as high as $50.
So here again, barriers to entry, just getting into the shared economy, the gig economy in the first place.
Exactly. Yeah, major barriers to entry. And of course, this is sort of hidden for a lot of workers until they try to enter.
We haven't mentioned anybody by name yet. I want to get to some of the individual stories, and I suspect you probably changed some names anyway. But the story of Donald, who you identify as a struggler in the three categories, strugglers, strivers, and success stories. Why, for example, did Donald at age 55 latch onto TaskRabbit?
Oh, Donald, yes. So I have changed all the names. That's one of the ethical aspects of sociology research. You have to protect people's identities. But Donald turned to TaskRabbit after being a member of the long-term unemployed. So he lost his job as part of the Great Recession. He worked a number of short-term jobs ranging for a couple of months, and they all seemed to be rather like moving downward. He started originally in finance, and then he ended up working as an assistant for a couple of things. He worked for an interior decorator who didn't pay him. He was helping people sell things on eBay. And then he turns to TaskRabbit, and he's actually able to help himself a good deal. He's making several thousand dollars in a month. He actually talks about how it helps to fight his depression because it forces him to get out of bed each day so that he can go and do a task. And then somebody complains, and he is suddenly deactivated by the platform, and he has no recourse, and he can't even get an explanation from the platform about why he was deactivated. And I interviewed him a couple days after he was deactivated, and he was highly distraught. He was trying to come up with explanations for why somebody, like why he was deactivated. You know, I used the bathroom at the local gym because there was nowhere else I could go. Or maybe I took too long on a cleaning task. Maybe that's what the problem was. And this is an example of the level of power that these platforms have, that you can be deactivated at a moment's notice and with no way to get a response. There's no HR office if you're in the gig economy.
No avenue of appeal when you're told you're removed from the TaskRabbit community.
Exactly.
Wow. Workers have, in some cases, sued their platforms for recognition as employees, not as contractors, to try to get some of the rights that workers have grown accustomed to. And you give another history lesson here about American worker protections and how they don't seem to be that common in the gig economy. I giggle inappropriately here, I realize. But what then has happened in these cases where people sued for recognition as employees instead of contractors?
So some of them are still working their way through the courts, and some of the issue is also going to be sort of state-based. So, for instance, some drivers, when they found themselves deactivated by Uber, have actually been able to get unemployment benefits, but it very much depends on their state. So in New York, for instance, they have, and I believe in California, but in many other states, they've been simply out of luck, and it partly depends on sort of state policies. Most recently, however, not a lawsuit, but we did see some organizing by Instacart workers. And Instacart is a grocery delivery service, pickup and delivery service. And workers found that their money, if a client tipped them, that money was actually being used to reduce Instacart's financial responsibility to the worker. So if you were tipped $10, and you were supposed to get paid $10.40. Instacart only paid 40 cents, and the other $10 came from the client tip. And workers were able to actually organize and draw a lot of attention to this and actually get the company to change their policies so that the workers would get the full tip level.
You also write about an actor who got a part out of town in New York. He got a part in Texas, so obviously he didn't take TaskRabbit jobs in New York for a while. What happened to that person?
He was also deactivated. He was deactivated for not, you know, the companies market themselves as something you can do on a flexible schedule, but TaskRabbit had requirements that you accept tasks within a certain period of time. So you couldn't go 2 or 3 months without doing a task. They would deactivate you. And he ended up arguing with a customer service representative for hours about this. They wanted him to attend orientation again, which is an unpaid 2-hour meeting, in order to learn more about TaskRabbit. And his argument was, this is supposed to be flexible work. This is supposed to be created for people like me who want to travel or who need to travel for their acting gigs. And he eventually was able to get reactivated. But a lot of times they also require the workers to go through sort of a re-education where they have to take quizzes and explain that they understand the rules by TaskRabbit and they will play nicely and follow the policies.
Wow. So you spent like several hours with each of the 80 people here. Did they end up revealing more over time? In some cases, their circumstances clearly changed over time.
Yes. It's one of the fascinating things that comes from this research is that workers are, people I speak to always say, my Uber driver, my TaskRabbit, they love the work. But the conversation that comes out in 15 minutes is very different from the one that comes out in 2 or 3 hours. And so one of the things that would often come up is that workers would find themselves in these sexual harassment situations, or they'd find themselves in really criminally questionable tasks, like being hired, they thought, to pick up someone's prescription at a pharmacy and then being asked to mail it to China, and it ended up being a large bottle of amphetamines. Or workers found themselves getting injured on the job or just facing really difficult situations. And these are the stories that only come out after a couple of hours of really building rapport and helping people to feel comfortable talking about it. It also helps that when I'm doing these interviews, I'm not their boss. You know, if you're taking Yeah. If you're taking an Uber or if you're a client of an Airbnb, they're not going to tell you the full story because in that moment, you are their boss.
Ah, that's an excellent point. Do people, I wonder, Alexandria, I don't know if you've found many of them in your flock of 80 who spend much time in the gig economy, if they have difficulty finding permanent full-time work later, or if they're in the gig economy perhaps because they couldn't in the first place?
I'm so glad you asked that. So right now I'm actually doing follow-up work with the individuals that I interviewed, and there's somebody who, when I first met him, he said he was just doing this as a temporary thing. He actually had a PhD, and he's still doing it. And I ask about it, and he says, well, you know, it's addicting. It's like gambling, except I don't necessarily have to spend the money. I never know if I'm going to get the work, if I'm not going to get the work, what's going to happen, what the situation is going to be. And so, yeah, we have sort of both cases. There are individuals who can't find other work, and so they turn to the gig work. And then there's also a situation that arises where workers get used to this. And I feel like that's almost more concerning because you get used to not having any rights and not having protections and not being treated well at work. And that can have larger repercussions for our society.
And then less than a minute left now, Alexandria. For us as consumers, are there things we should think about when making use of the labor of gig workers?
Yes, definitely. If you're going to tip people, and I would urge people to tip in cash, you should also really spend some time thinking about how the workers are being treated on these platforms. And don't think that you can just ask the worker. Really, you know, pay attention to some of the critical work that's being done on this and how we're seeing these repercussions sort of trickle throughout society.
We have learned a lot, and a lot of it has been mentioned before, but here it all is in one place. The book is called Hustle and Gig, Struggling and Surviving in the Sharing Economy. Publication date of March 12th. It is the work of Alexandria J. Ravenel, who is an associate professor of sociology at Mercy College in New York. Thank you so much for joining us today.